I'm Susan Yawkey with VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Coming up, the U.S. says Syria's president will not be in a transitional government. Reaction to a proposed conference on Syria.
As you watch the huge human cost of this conflict, there's a kind of need, at the very least, to be seen to be trying to do something.
U.S. officials criticize the American response to the Benghazi attack. And the PKK starts withdrawing from Turkey into Iraq. It's all ahead. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry says a transitional government in Syria would not include President Bashar al-Assad. He made the statement today in Rome, where he was meeting with the Jordanian foreign minister.
The foreign minister will work with us, as they have, to try to bring all of the parties to the table so that we can effect a transition government by mutual consent on both sides, which clearly means that, in our judgment, President Assad will not be a component of that transitional government.
U.S. State Department spokesman Patrick Ventrell, in a give and take with reporters, said the United States has long called for Mr. Assad to quit.
Our policy has not changed. The sooner he leaves, the better. And we've been clear about that for a very long time.
He will leave it up to the Syrian opposition and government within the Geneva framework to decide Assad's future. Doesn't this contradict President Obama's statements that Assad should step down?
No, our policy has not changed. Assad needs to go, and the sooner the better. But it's up to the Syrian people, and it's up to the Syrian opposition as they work through this process. Let me finish. It has always been based on mutual consent by both sides. And so it's been both the regime and the opposition have to have mutual consent about sitting down and working toward this transitional authority.
Syria's main opposition coalition has long demanded that any peace process begin with Mr. Assad and top security officials leaving power. Earlier this week, Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov announced their hope to convene an international conference later in May to launch Syrian peace talks. The diplomats say they will try to persuade the two sides to negotiate based on a plan that calls for a transitional government leading to elections. United Nations Arab League envoy Lakhdar Brahimi said Wednesday the U.S.-Russian initiative on Syria is the first hopeful news concerning that unhappy country in a very long time. He says the initiative is only a first step, but added that he has every reason to expect that all members of the U.N. Security Council will cooperate to carry the process forward. We asked David Butter of Chatham House in London for his reaction to the proposed Syrian conference.
Well, the initial reaction was slightly puzzled because it had seemed that any idea of getting a diplomatic or political process going again on Syria really, you know, wasn't there. However, it did appear to be to reflect a concern from the U.S. administration and perhaps from the Russians as well to try to move back to some slightly more common approach on Syria and to avoid the issue, pulling them further apart.
Which way do you think they should go at this conference?
Well, I think anybody trying to see how you could get representatives from the Assad regime and of the opposition to take part in this conference finds it very difficult to see how that could come about. The opposition said that they appreciate international efforts, but they want any initiative to start from the point of President Bashar al-Assad stepping down. And then the Russians and the Americans have all had different interpretations of what this Geneva communique should mean. It talks about a transition, and the American side and Secretary of State Kerry, I think, emphasized this today, has made very clear that President Assad should have no part in any kind of transitional government. I think the Russians consider that to be prejudging the negotiation, implying thereby that it's unrealistic to expect Assad to stand back from any sort of process at this very initial stage. So, it doesn't look at all feasible to get anybody of the actual participants to take part in this conference. Of course, also when we're talking about the opposition, we're talking about some, you know, bodies on the outside that talk on behalf of the opposition, but who do not really represent what's going on the ground.
Yeah, I was going to say this Syrian opposition is quite a collection of different groups and opinions and interests. That's going to complicate everything.
It certainly is. I mean, even if you look at the National Coalition, that body is, you know, which the I think the American administration tried to kind of relaunch back in November, that's been prey to constant infighting. We did have the emergence of a rather charismatic leader in the form of Muaz al-Khatib after that Doha meeting, but then he has now resigned, and so it's very unclear as to who actually has a mandate to lead that organization. We do have perhaps a slightly more coherent figure heading the Supreme Military Council, but again, we have a problem there of the limited extent to which he, General Salim Idris, actually controls what's happening on the ground, where we see literally hundreds of different groups and very significant roles being played by Jabhat al-Nusra, a group designated by the U.S. as being terrorists. So it really is very hard to see you know, what any kind of opposition representation in a conference would consist of.
In this thick pea soup of an affair, do you see any way to reach a negotiated settlement in Syria?
At the moment, it seems very difficult. I mean, I think, you know, everybody who watches this conflict closely, I think, has to admit that they find it hard to see any way out of it. There doesn't seem to be any clear advantage on the ground. Maybe a couple of months ago, you could see that the rebels were starting to make progress in the last few weeks. It looks like the regime has been hitting back quite effectively, but you really don't have any sense that one side is going to prevail. But you know, no appetite on either side to sort of reach out, declare a ceasefire, and try to start negotiations. And I suppose from the international perspective, as you watch the huge human cost of this conflict, there's a kind of need, at the very least, to be seen to be trying to do something, and that perhaps is how we can interpret the Russian-American initiative.
David Butter, Associate Fellow in the Middle East and North Africa program at Chatham House in London. More than 1 million Syrians have fled the conflict in their homeland, seeking refuge in countries nearby. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett reports on those who have landed in Egypt and the creation of a Little Syria just west of Cairo.
While Mustafa left Syria last year with his family, his cooking skills, and little else. Now working in a busy shawarma restaurant near Cairo, Mustafa explains how he got here. After abandoning his devastated home on the outskirts of Damascus, Mustafa, his wife, children, and aging parents spent months seeking safety in one town after another. But war always followed, so they fled to Beirut, then on to Cairo.
Here I start from the zero.
He's one of the lucky ones.
Because here everything is easy. The people easy, to find job easy, to move here easy.
The restaurant Mustafa works in is in Little Syria, a neighborhood in a desert city west of Cairo. He's one of 140,000 Syrian refugees in Egypt, nearly half of whom are registering with the United Nations Refugee Program. Most are opposed to Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. Shops include the Bakery of the Revolution. But Mustafa deflects questions about the politics of the conflict, now in its third year.
Nobody knows who will win. Until now, nobody win. All the people Syrian now lose.
Many refugees manage only to make it across the border, landing in camps in Jordan or other neighboring countries, proving a strain to their hosts. Sayed Sadek of the American University in Cairo says that's not the case with refugees in Egypt.
They are not fighters. They are just middle-class, low-income people who had to escape from the atrocities and the violence. And it is a second home.
Egypt and Syria were once bound in the United Arab Republic, and family, cultural, and Sunni religious ties run deep. The government treats them far differently than exiles from Iraq, Sudan, or Palestinian lands. Mohammed Dairi is the regional representative for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees.
Thanks God we have the Egyptian government who has decided to grant them access to public schools since last September, in addition to the access of all Syrians in Egypt to public health facilities.
But some worry how long the goodwill can last. Egypt has troubles of its own. And with the devastation of Syria so thorough, refugees, Mustafa among them, are uncertain when they can return.
I don't know. I hope I will not stay here too much, but I think it will be get more, about 20 years or more.
That's a prospect daunting to all concerned. Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
A senior State Department official has criticized America's security response during last year's deadly attack on a U.S. facility in Benghazi, Libya, and he's expressed dismay over the Obama administration's initial characterization of the assault as a popular protest rather than a terrorist attack. VOA's Michael Bowman reports three officials testified before the House of Representatives Oversight Committee, the latest congressional probe into the attack that killed four Americans, including Ambassador Christopher Stevens.
The attack and the killing of the U.S. ambassador to Libya shocked the nation and sparked calls for an investigation. 8 months later, the controversy and the allegations continue. The former deputy head of the U.S. Embassy in Tripoli, Gregory Hicks, told lawmakers that a request to airlift additional security forces to Benghazi during the attack was denied.
They were not authorized to travel. They remained in Tripoli with us.
Hicks said he was also told that U.S. aircraft in Italy could not respond in time, leaving him with this chilling thought.
Okay, we're on our own. We're going to have to try to pull this off with the resources that we have available.
When Susan Rice, Washington's ambassador to the UN, went on national television and characterized the Benghazi attack as a popular protest, Hicks was dismayed.
I was stunned. My jaw dropped, and I was embarrassed.
Some Republican lawmakers have accused the Obama administration of incompetence in responding to the Benghazi attack and of attempting to mislead the American people afterwards. Democrats point out that exhaustive reviews of the incident identified security lapses but no intentional wrongdoing. Congressman Elijah Cummings sympathized with Gregory Hicks' desire for U.S. air support over Benghazi.
If I were in your shoes, I would have wanted them to get there yesterday. And that is completely understandable, but the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff said they simply could not get there quickly.
The three State Department whistleblowers said they wanted to provide a full accounting of events in Benghazi. Hicks alleged that superiors pressured him against speaking with lawmakers probing the attack. The State Department denies attempting to muzzle anyone. Diplomatic Security Officer Eric Nordstrom said the truth matters.
It matters to me personally, and it matters to my colleagues at the Department of State. It matters to the American public for whom we serve.
The committee's chairman, Republican Darrell Issa, agreed.
Our goal in this investigation is to get answers.
Issa said the families of those killed in Benghazi especially deserve answers. But Democrats see politics at play. Once again, Elijah Cummings.
What we have seen over the past 2 weeks is a full-scale media campaign that is not designed to investigate what happened in a responsible and bipartisan way, but rather unfounded accusations to smear public officials.
The Benghazi attack occurred at the height of President Barack Obama's re-election campaign. It could resurface in presidential politics in 2016 if former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton decides to run for office. Michael Bowman, VOA News, the Capitol.
However, White House Press Secretary Jay Carney told reporters that Republican lawmakers questioning about the administration's conduct in the Benghazi attack is politically motivated.
I mean, this is a subject that has, from its beginning, been subject to attempts to politicize it by Republicans, when in fact what happened in Benghazi was a tragedy, and the president has been committed from day one to two things, making sure that those who are responsible for the deaths of four Americans are found and brought to justice, and that we do everything we need to do to ensure that this kind of attack cannot happen again. And the standing up of the Accountability Review Board by then-Secretary Clinton, with the full support of the President, demonstrates the seriousness with which she took this issue. That board, that review board, issued a report that was unsparing and highly critical in some areas, and was led by two highly respected nonpartisan experts in the field of national security, Admiral Mullen and Ambassador Pickering. And that report issued, contained within it, a series of recommendations, every single one of which has been acted on or is being acted on by the State Department.
White House Press Secretary Jay Carney said the information discussed at Wednesday's hearing already was known and that the administration has cooperated with all investigations. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry announced Wednesday that he will return to the Middle East this month in hopes of reviving the Israeli-Palestinian peace process. Mr. Kerry said he plans to talk separately with Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. He spoke in Rome prior to a meeting there with Israeli Justice Minister Zippy Levni, whose cabinet portfolio includes responsibility for peace talks.
We are really working with very serious purpose on the behalf of everybody who's been part of this. Prime Minister Netanyahu, President Abbas, the folks working around them. I met last week in Washington with Cy Barakat, the envoy for Minister for President Abbas. And I think it's fair to say that we are working through threshold questions, but we're doing it with a seriousness of purpose that I think Minister Livni would agree with me has not been present in a while. And we all believe that we're working with a short time span. We understand an imperative to try to have some sense of direction as rapidly as we can. So I'm grateful for their ability to be here. I think the announcement by the Arab League last week was an important step forward. And I spoke again this morning with Prime Minister Hamad bin Jassim of Qatar, who was the chairman of that committee. They want to keep the progress moving. They have asked for ongoing meetings, and we will have those ongoing meetings, but with a purpose. We don't want to have a meeting for the sake of a meeting. So over the course of the next weeks, we're going to continue our work. I will be traveling back to Israel to meet with both Prime Minister Netanyahu as well as President Abbas around the 21st or 22nd of this month.
U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry in Rome. Peace negotiations have been stalled since late 2008. Palestinian officials say they will not negotiate until Israel stops building settlements in the West Bank and East Jerusalem. Israelis want talks with no preconditions. China separately hosted both Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu this week, as Beijing appears interested in playing a bigger role as a mediator in the Mideast conflict. Shannon Van Sant in this report for VOA Television has more on that story from Beijing.
Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu was welcomed in Beijing on Wednesday. He is the first Israeli leader to visit China since 2007. Mr. Netanyahu's trip comes the same week Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas visited Beijing, where President Xi Jinping presented a four-point peace plan. China has historically backed Palestinian positions and only formally established diplomatic ties with Israel in 1992. But Xiaohe Chang, a professor of international relations at Renmin University, says Beijing is seeking to play the role of mediator in the Middle East.
Certainly China will want to play a larger role, but China has no intention to replace the United States to serve as a principal mediators in peacemaking process in the Middle East.
There are still key political differences between China and Israel on issues such as Syria. Beijing opposes outside military intervention, but Israel is suspected of carrying out airstrikes in Syria in recent days. When asked about the strikes this week, China's foreign ministry declined to mention Israel by name.
We hope all sides in Syria will respect Syria's sovereignty and territorial integrity, remain restrained and calm, avoiding the use of military force and acts that might raise tension.
Professor Xiaohe says this week's meetings will focus on areas of cooperation between China and Israel, such as boosting economic ties.
Netanyahu's visit to China was aimed at strengthening economic ties between the two countries. And at the same time, you see that Israel has been the principal providers of high-tech know-how to China. And I think the two countries could continue to cooperate in the technological cooperation areas.
Although President Abbas and Prime Minister Netanyahu did not meet each other while in China this week, Beijing has an economic interest in brokering peace and stability in the region. Trade between China and Israel has grown to $8 billion annually from $50 million just two decades ago. And China is now the largest importer of Middle East oil in the world. Shannon Van Sant for VOA News, Beijing.
Members of the Kurdish rebel group, the PKK, have started withdrawing from Turkey into neighboring Iraq. The move is being seen as a crucial step in the peace process. But both sides are voicing concerns over the withdrawal process. Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul.
The withdrawal of the estimated 1,500 to 2,000 fighters is part of ongoing peace efforts to end the nearly three decades-long fighting with the Turkish state. The spokesman and deputy head of the ruling AK party, Hüseyin Çelik, said in a press statement Wednesday that the withdrawal is the latest positive development in peace efforts. The fact that fingers are lifted off the triggers, that the guns are now silent and the bombs are no longer exploding is a first step, and this is important, he said. However, disarming the PKK is a priority of the government, and Turkish Prime Minister Recep Tayyip Erdogan on Tuesday reiterated his call for the withdrawing rebels to lay down their arms before leaving the country. The PKK has refused to disarm its withdrawing forces. PKK military leader Murat Karayalan voiced concern over what he claims is an increase in Turkish military activity, and in particular the presence of unmanned drones in the region, from which they are withdrawing. In 1999, the last time the PKK withdrew its forces from Turkey, it suffered heavy losses at the hands of the Turkish army. The co-leader of the pro-Kurdish BDP, Gültan Kuşanak, expressed concern over the latest withdrawal. Recalling the PKK withdrawal of 1999, she said that they will hold the government responsible for any military operation. She added that disarmament will only come as part of a political process. Prime Minister Erdogan has promised that PKK rebels will not be attacked while they withdraw. But he also said the risk of confrontation would be minimized if the rebels were unarmed. Thus far, there have been no formal negotiations between the PKK and the Turkish government. The current withdrawal is the result of informal talks between the head of the Turkish intelligence, Hakan Fidan, and the imprisoned PKK leader, Abdullah Öcalan. Kadri Gusel, a columnist for the Turkish newspaper Milliyet, who is an expert on the Kurdish conflict, says expectations for government concessions will grow during the withdrawal.
The expectation of the PKK will be to see major steps taken in the direction of solving the Kurdish problem. If Turkey will be reluctant to take these steps, this will be a looming menace over Turkey. But the process itself gains its own independent momentum and dynamic right now. And those who will impede this process will bear major responsibility and will pay a price.
Prime Minister Erdogan has ruled out any formal negotiations with or concessions to the PKK before its forces withdraw from Turkey. Now that withdrawal has started, Turkey is likely to feel more pressure to take steps to meet Kurdish demands. Both the PKK and political Kurdish leaders are calling for the release of thousands of activists from jail, as well as political and cultural reforms. Dorian Jones for VOA News, Istanbul, Turkey.
This has been VOA's Middle East Monitor podcast. Join us Monday through Friday for news from the region and of interest to the region. And for more Mideast coverage, visit our website at MiddleEastVoices.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Thanks for joining us.